Do you enjoy listening to A Darker Tale? Consider supporting the podcast on Patreon/A Darker Tale. Even $1 a month will help us get out stories more regularly. Thanks for your support. Now, on with the show. The discovery of two dead sheep on a misty morning marked the beginning of the two most fearful weeks of my life. It was 1902 at the time, which means I was 11 years old. I was an innocent girl living in a farmhouse with my parents, in a small village in Northern Ireland. It was not the first time that livestock had been killed. My father often worried about the foxes, because sometimes when they got hungry in the winter, they'd eat our chickens. Despite his efforts, they occasionally managed to get through the fence. But the idea that an animal as big as a sheep was being hunted by a predator, that initially seemed unlikely to my father. Wolves were already extinct in Ireland, at least as far as he knew. I only knew wolves from fairy tale books, a simple allegory for evil. But I had never seen them in the flesh, and nobody in the village had either. The sheep had been butchered in the night, but nobody had heard a thing. It was certainly odd, but nobody made a big fuss over it, and soon everyone went on with their lives. Just when I had forgotten about the two dead sheep, the first human victim was found. There was more blood this time, probably because it was somewhat warmer that night, and therefore the blood had not immediately frozen. All the children were kept away from this horrific find that was discovered on the path towards the big meadow behind the village. I, however, managed to slip past the two farmers and saw with my own eyes how the man had been torn open. His guts hung from his fat belly, and a dark pool of blood had formed around his body. I only regretted my decision to slip past later, because at that moment, I just let my eyes run wild. I eagerly absorbed the scene, taking in every detail. It was not so much the wounds that had become fatal to the victim that stayed with me, but the appearance of death itself. That gaze that seemed to stare into infinity, and the stiff fingers that had turned gray in some places and purple in others. The victim, lying on the cold ground, was an old farmer named Arlen Walsh. He was generally known as a grumpy alcoholic who regularly misbehaved in the local tavern, where he usually made scruffy remarks to women he would have forgotten the next day. His death was foreseen to a certain extent. That the bottle would kill him one day was inevitable. But that he would be killed in such a cruel way was a surprise to everyone. It was the way in which he was killed that changed the atmosphere in the village. Death was not unusual, but violence was. I remember that the days after the body was found, nobody could talk of anything else other than the brutal killing. It was beyond question that a murder had taken place. The question remaining was who or what was responsible. It was a young woman named Mary O'Byrne who proposed to inform the police. Our nameless village had not needed real police since 1890, when a thief from Edinburgh had raided two farms while passing through town. Perhaps that is why Mary's idea was received with some skepticism. But in the end, the village council agreed that external forces were needed to track down Mr. Walsh's killer. The dead sheep could be attributed to a rabid animal, or perhaps even the attack of a large bird of prey. But a butchered human being, was a completely different case. The telephone had already been invented around that time, but there were no lines in our remote village yet. It was Mr. O'Byrne, the husband of Mary, who took on the task of riding the horse to Galway, the closest city with an active police force. Arlen's body was kept in a stable, so the detective could have a look at it later. I remember how scared everyone was. Not just the children. What had happened was hard to comprehend in a sleepy town like ours. Just to paint a picture, the most exciting thing that had happened over the past couple of years was probably the fire that had burned down an abandoned mill a few summers before. That event was talked about for weeks, so you can imagine how Arlen's violent end was on everybody's mind. In anticipation of the return of Mr. O'Byrne, the village council decided to set a curfew for all the 120 inhabitants of the village, for nobody knew if the killer would strike again. After dark, everyone had to hide inside their homes to avert the possible recurrence of danger, although nobody knew exactly who or what that danger was. Still, there were no exceptions. It was not until dawn that the villagers, of whom two-thirds worked on the land, were allowed outside again. 20 men took the initiative of an evening watch. They would line up in various places in the village, armed with hunting rifles. A number of them would stay guard outside, and another part of the community would watch the roads from their windows, in hopes of spotting the maniac or monster or whatever it was that had killed the sheep and Mr. Arlen, just to see if it was foolish enough to return to the village. I hardly slept the first night. I listened to the harsh wind outside, and I counted the wooden beams on my ceiling over and over again. A trick that normally worked flawlessly to make me tired, but that night, I could only think of the evil that was possibly lurking around the corner. A strong fog had developed, and therefore I was only just able to distinguish the Irish hills from the night sky when I looked through my window. I was so scared I was thinking of getting out of bed and asking my parents for a glass of milk, but I knew my dad would be furious if I woke him up. So I just looked out of the window, mistaking shadows and clouds for monsters. In the end, it was anticlimactic. Nothing happened that night, and the men had stayed up for nothing. My morning routine consisted of milking the four cows, and then I had to feed the goats. It was still dusk when I left the house after a quick breakfast, and a white fog blocked my view. I was still tired because I had barely slept, but I opened my eyes as widely as I could. Still, I saw nothing. I held out my arm to see how far I was able to see and concluded that my fingertips completely disappeared in the fog. I called my mother and I said I couldn't see anything. She grabbed my arm and said strictly that the cows should still be milked. The goats could wait until the afternoon, when the visibility, hopefully, was a little better. Moreover, she said I could hurt myself in the fog if I wasn't careful of my steps, and that there was the matter of the killer, or the beast, but she was too busy herself to accompany me on my chores, so she thought of a solution. "I want you to call your name every 100 seconds, so that I know you are safe and sound. Do you understand that?" she said. My mother had always been a rational woman, but I could tell she was a little frightened now. When I arrived at the stable, I noticed that the cows were restless. One snorted loudly and shuffled restlessly back and forth. I started counting while wondering if it was due to the fog. Even inside the stable, there seemed to be something ominous hanging in the air. The place gave me a claustrophobic feeling, something I had never experienced. I hardly knew what freedom was at that age. It didn't mean anything to me. I had never seen anything other than the vast hills of the country where I was born. Those brown and green hills always gave me the feeling that it was possible to disappear behind them. That somewhere, far beyond the horizon, there was another world that you could visit if you really wanted to. The fog gave me the opposite sense, as if it was silently figuring out how to swallow me up. I counted and called my name so loud I knew my mother could hear me. When I started milking the first cow, I saw that she was scared. I spent time with the animals every day, and I knew them well enough to read their emotion from their behavior. The difference between a calm or a pregnant cow, for example, meant that you had to approach the animal differently. Now, I saw something in that black, gleaming eye that I had not seen before. I stroked the animal to calm it, but it continued to wheeze, the eyes moving back and forth fast, seemingly anticipating grave danger. At that moment, I realized that I was not alone, and my breathing stopped. Not because I saw or heard something, but because I felt something. I froze and looked around me. I suddenly felt no different than that poor, terrified cow in front of me. An easy prey, frozen in place by fear. After a minute or so, I slowly left the stable, and to my horror, I saw a silhouette move in the fog. I couldn't see more than a big and dark shape, but it was at least twice as large as me. I opened my mouth to scream, but no sound came out. Instead, I felt the tears welling up in my eyes. The silhouette remained motionless and did not move a muscle. I prayed to God and closed my eyes so that I would not see what monstrous creature was going to kill me. Then, I heard my mother cry out. In a high, panicky voice, she called my name again and again and again. I had forgotten to call out now for at least a few minutes. I opened my eyes and saw the dark silhouette move. It turned its head towards the house and then moved away from the stable, disappearing into the fog. It moved calmly, as if it had only been irritated by my mother's shrill screams. Only when the beast was gone did I cry out, as loud as possible, while I ran towards the house as fast as I could. There, I told my mother what had happened, and I am not ashamed to say that I spent the rest of the day shaking in my bed, thanking my mother and God for the intervention. My mother barricaded the front door. Only when my father knocked did she remove the chairs, and together they decided that my experience needed to be shared with the other villagers. My dad forced me to tell him what I had seen in great detail. I don't know why, but every time I told it again, I made up a detail. Maybe it was my fantasy trying to intervene with the horrible reality which I had to cope. I don't know. I just couldn't help it. My father organized a meeting that same afternoon with almost all of the adults in the village. He brought them together in a large shed where the latest development in the chain of horrible occurrences was met with great shock. Now, it was finally clear what had killed Arlen. It wasn't one of the villagers or a stranger. No. It was a monster of sorts. A werewolf, maybe. It was decided that animal traps should be put up, and that the night watch should stay active until the beast was either captured or shot. The next morning, a loud scream woke me up. I flew out of my bed and ran to the living room, and not much later, my parents followed. Before we headed out, my father grabbed a pitchfork that he had taken into the house as a precaution. At first, my mom urged me to stay in the house, but I said I was afraid and that I'd rather go with them. After I began to cry, she agreed. That morning, the fog still persisted, so limiting our visibility. Together, the three of us walked in the direction that we thought the scream had come from. I was pleased to see that we were not the only ones venturing outside. We joined a few of our neighbors who had, like us, come outside to check on where that scream had come from. With a group of about 10 people, we finally ran into a womanly figure on the road. It turned out to be Miss Byrne. She looked even paler than usual and kept her fingers against the side of her head. I remember it was my father trying to calm her down, but his good intentions weren't fruitful. The woman was in shock and started shaking from head to toe. Two neighbors took care of her while the rest of the group hesitantly shuffled forward, frightened, but also curious, in the direction where the woman had come from. When we found what had made her scream, my father covered my eyes with his bulky hands, and I still remember the smell of his fingers, that odd mix of tobacco and mud. Still, he was not fast enough to prevent me from taking it in. The first thing I saw was his horse. Beside it was the corpse of Mr. O'Byrne. He had never made it farther than the edge of the village. His corpse had clearly been there for a while. The pool of blood around him had hardened, and despite the cold, countless maggots crept on the intestines that had been ripped out of his stomach. His horse grazed next to the corpse, as if blissfully unaware of what had happened to her rider. On her gray fur, I saw some blood splashes, which had to be from Mr. O'Byrne. Two people vomited on the spot. My father led us back to the house as quickly as he could, where he shouted at my mother that she had to barricade every door and every window. I realized that the death of Mr. O'Byrne meant that the police were never alerted, lest on their way to help us. We were on our own. I was surprised that the night watch had not found him. But then I realized that the men who had applied for it were just patrolling the streets and could have easily overlooked the corpse because it lay rotting just outside the town limits. Not much later, it was decided we could no longer take any risks. The townsfolk should stay as close to each other as possible, mainly because the persistent fog made it even more dangerous to move alone. After all, the monster seemed to kill his victims when they were isolated. All the women and children were housed together in a big barn, while the men decided that a small but skilled group of hunters had to search for the creature in the hills surrounding the village and kill it before it caused any more harm. Another party stayed behind to protect the women and children. Two terribly boring days followed. It may sound crazy, but after more than 48 hours in an overcrowded barn, without fresh air or anything to do, I became incredibly bored rather quickly. It is remarkable how fast dormant fear diminishes when you cannot focus on anything other than yourself. It was that third night when I lay awake while everyone was sleeping. My back hurt from the hard floor where I'd slept on, so I just listened to the snoring children in the barn. Then, all of a sudden, I saw the pale widow, Mary O'Byrne, standing up and sneaking out of one of the doors. She opened it careful as not to wake anyone. I think I was the only one that saw her leave, I knew I would be asking for problems, but my curiosity was too strong. And so, I followed her, softly crouching between the sleeping women and children, doing my best not to wake them. When I came close to the door, I saw that one of the night duty watchers that guarded the barn outside seemed to be stopping her. But instead of sending her back, I could see that he kissed her on the lips. Then, the young man left his spot, and Mrs. O'Byrne waited for a bit. Then she went outside as well. I waited for a short while before I carefully opened the door. I could just see the shape of Mrs. O'Byrne on the corner of the road. It was freezing outside, but I had to know where she was going. So I followed her, my feet just in socks, hurt from the frozen ground. I stayed away just far enough so I knew she wouldn't spot me. I remember I was in equal parts scared and excited. After a while, I saw Mrs. O'Byrne going into a stable. I didn't really know much about romance at that time, but I remember thinking that she was probably meeting that young man she had just kissed. Maybe she was going to do that thing that Mom and Dad did sometimes, when they thought I was fast asleep, I remember thinking. My curiosity made me draw closer to the barn, and in the end, I went past it, deciding not to go in, but to peek through a window. I pushed myself against the wall and looked inside. What I saw made me want to scream, but I kept quiet, and I quickly ran around the barn and got inside. Mrs. O'Byrne was sitting on the floor of the barn, and I could see that she held an object in her right hand. As I approached her slowly, she turned and stared at me with wide-open eyes. The dark red spots, which marked her face, stood out against her white skin. At first I thought she was hurt, but then I saw the bloody hammer she was clenching tightly in her hand. The hooks on the back shone with fresh blood. In front of her lay the body of the young man she had kissed only a few minutes earlier. It all came rushing to me then. It was Mary O'Byrne, who had used the back of the hammer to simulate that the beast was responsible. She had used the back of the hammer to rip him open, and probably the other dead villagers as well. Mary's eyes were wide open. All of a sudden, she dropped the hammer on the floor, and a dull clap followed. I knew Mrs. O'Byrne fairly well. She and her husband watched me over a few times when my parents were out selling calves in the neighboring town, 14 miles away. But that moment, I knew we were complete strangers. Then, she beckoned me, but I stepped back. "It's not what it seems," she tried, but her broken voice told me she knew any plea was meaningless. I'd seen it. I had witnessed her. And although I was a child, she knew I was not stupid. "Please, please wait," she whispered. And I could see from her trembling lower lip that she could burst into tears at any moment. But she recovered and extended her hand to me. I looked at her for a moment, and then started running while I heard Mary screaming my name. When I arrived at the big barn, I woke everyone and told them what I'd seen. It didn't take long before Mary was arrested, and, for lack of a prison, was held in the now empty home of her first victim, Mr. Walsh. 2 days later, the fog finally cleared, and Mary was hanged in front of the entire village. There was hardly a trial. My testimony and the bloody hammer were brought forward as evidence. And the strange thing was that I started to doubt what I had seen after I realized what my testimony meant. My words had marked her death. Mary screamed and screamed that I was lying. Before the rope broke her neck. I remember how suddenly the silence came. The silence that followed the first public execution of our town in 80 years. There was a lot of discussion about what to do with Mary's body. It was finally decided that, despite her wishes, it would be inappropriate to bury her next to her husband, given that she was his murderer. She was thrown into a shallow grave on the outskirts of the village, without any form of ceremony. A wooden symbol with her name carved in it was everything that reminded the townsfolk of her death and the horrible deeds she had committed. Over the years, Mary O'Byrne became a legend in the area. People who wanted to discourage their children from wandering too far from the village told stories about her wandering spirit. If it wasn't for my curiosity, she could have gotten away with the murders. Some say she was just mad, killing for the sake of killing. Others formed a more plausible theory for the murders. They said she used the convenient death of the sheep to kill her husband, so she could marry the man she was having an affair with. When the man had found out what she had done, he was going to rat her out. So she had to kill him too. But the big problem with that theory was that Arlen's death wasn't really explained. Maybe she used his death to fuel the fear. Nobody really knew the truth behind her motives. Because till the end, she persisted that she wasn't the killer. So that gave people the opportunity to speculate. My father sometimes said he thought it was ridiculous that she was still being talked about that often. Everyone should forget such a heartless wretch as quickly as possible, he said bitterly. But I knew he could never forget her. Even if he tried. My parents had always been on good terms with the O'Byrnes, and I think he was ashamed of not seeing through her, that he had trusted her to watch over his child. I often dream about Mary. Sometimes, I fear that she will indeed come back in the form of a spirit to punish me for my betrayal. If that happens, I will apologize before she smashes my head in with her hammer. So far, you've believed every word I said, right? Well, I think it's time for the truth now. It wasn't Mary who killed those people. It was me. The story I just told you is the one that people still believe in the village and its sleepy surroundings. I want it to stay that way, because nobody can know what Mr. O'Byrne has done to me. The bastard. His wife Mary covered for him. That's a crime as well, right? Therefore, I feel like she deserved to be killed as well. To know your husband took advantage of a 10-year-old and just let that slide? To stay quiet about it? It makes me sick. I was glad I didn't have to kill her with my own hands. How convenient that the townsfolk did that for me. No matter her protests, nobody would even listen to her. Everybody believed me. For how could an innocent child like me ever lie? But I do have to admit, I feel terrible about killing the sheep. They were innocent, but I just had to do it. So I had a good story, so that everybody's imagination would run wild. Arlen wasn't hard to kill. I just slipped out of bed and waited for him to leave the bar, drunk as hell. I felt quite neutral about killing him. His death was a crucial part of the plan. It got everyone to believe that there was a monster at large. In fact, I think I did everyone a favor by getting rid of that useless drunk. And it was good practice. My last victim, the boy, didn't really deserve to die. But I needed a crime scene so everybody would believe my story. When I found out he had an affair with Mary O'Byrne one day, I considered it an opportunity. And so, I started plotting. I didn't enjoy killing him with the hammer, but I found some comfort in the fact that he was a man, and all men are disgusting to some extent. The fact that Mary cared for him made it easier as well. When I killed Mr. O'Byrne, I felt overjoyed. It was my sweet revenge. The best thing was he barely saw me coming. Who suspects a little girl to come after you with a knife? I made him come off his horse with some silly excuse and pulled out a knife I got from the kitchen. I stabbed him a few times in the chest, and while he collapsed, I opened up his gut while keeping him still. Then I just watched while he lay there, dying. How he choked on his own blood. I quietly laughed, and I hoped he remembered my face while he burned in hell. This story is released under an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives 4.0 International Creative Commons license. This story was narrated by me, Shelby Scott, from the Scare You to Sleep podcast. Make sure to check it out. This story was written by A Darker Tale. Please subscribe to the podcast or consider supporting us on patreon.com/adarkertale. Thanks for listening.